The show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Welcome to the program. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. It's time for another hour. That's right. We're going to get things going with more of the program. As I said, Bucket Strategy Investing. We do our best to pass along to you the best in money strategies and the best in money information. A lot of bests there, but that's what we're all about. Professor Rick Plum, our brain trust advisor, is here with me, Johnny Dean, once again from Lucia Capital Group. We got some more topics to cover this hour. We got some more of your emails and phone calls and all that, as we usually do on this show. Now, here are your directions if you want to take part in the discussion. And I know you've got money questions, so if you have a money question of any kind, you call us right now. Our phone lines are open at the top of the hour, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R, 877-752-6637. And again, if you'd like to memorize these things, that spells out PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. You want to add to the stack of emails that we're going to get to on the program this hour, and here's what you do. You go over to wealthed.com, click on the Find Your Answer link there near the top of the page. We'll get your questions answered right here in the studio. We're going to take your phone calls in less than 60 seconds. I want to remind you, though, that Professor Rick Plum, who's here with me, is a certified financial planner, and he returns this hour courtesy of the people at Lucia Capital Group. We try to deliver on this program the strategies that are right for you, the money strategies that could potentially help you get through retirement. If you need to talk to an advisor off the air, you can always call Professor Plum or any of the advisors, the Brain Trust advisors, at Lucia Capital Group. Their off-air number, 800-644-1150. You should find out if your individual retirement goals and needs are being met. If not, maybe you should talk to somebody. Your situation is unique to you, and the Brain Trust will help you with your own plan. They've got access to a network of Brain Trust advisors all across the country. Once again, 800-644-1150. That's the off-air number. On the air, 877-PLANNER. Now, we have a couple of people that were hanging on there during the top of the hour, so we're going to get to them first here and take more of your questions. But if you'd like to take part, we still have two lines open at 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. Let's start off with Ed this hour in Palm Springs with a question or three. Hello, Ed.
Hi. Hi, guys. Nice to talk to you. Thanks for the service that you provide.
You're welcome.
Just a few general guidelines, if you would, please, for me. I was an employee at a company, and in 2006, the company started an employee stock ownership plan, an ESOP. Mm-hmm. And in exchange for that, they stopped giving a matching company contribution to the employee's 401k. So over the years, they gave us some money in this ESOP, each and every one of us. It was supposed to go for 10 years, but when the recession hit in 08 and 09, the ESOP ended up stopping the contributions to all of our individual accounts, so to speak, in 2010. Fast forward now to 2015 and 16. Many of us were laid off in late 2015. The company sold most of its assets to another company in late 2015. What are my rights under ERISA, under an ESOP plan? Do I get to get that money? The company stipulates that I have to wait till I'm 65. I say I should be able to roll over some of that ESOP money that was given to me over the years. I should be able to roll that into my individual IRA.
And typically that's what is happening. An ESOP is an employee stock ownership plan where the only asset within that part of the retirement plan is the company stock. You are an right. owner of the company. You own the stock along with everybody else that works for the company. So you have all rights and privileges as an owner. So the ongoing company is you and your fellow employees. The management can't sell off assets and pocket the money in any way. That should go back into the stock price. And so it should help the stock. Now, you should be able to, now you're no longer with the company. There should be some provisions for selling the stock. Is it a publicly traded company?
No, it is not a publicly traded company. It was an individually held company.
Right. Well, of course, it wouldn't be a publicly traded company now I think about it. That's the whole idea of an ESOP. And so you have to look at the original writing on what you can and cannot do. And depending upon what's happening with that company, there may be restrictions on who can and when they can sell the stock. So before it went into trouble, you go back and look at the original writing and the original opening And you may need to hire, you and maybe some of your other employees, you know, fellow employees, need to hire an attorney to tell you what you can have, because they can be written with a little bit of latitude on what, when somebody, because it's a non-publicly traded company, how does that company, how does the plan buy out the shares of the people leaving? Because where does that plan get the money to buy out your shares when the only thing in the plan are the shares? And so,
right.
So you have to go back to the original documentation to figure out what your rights are and when you can sell it.
Okay, well, because right now we're not given any information. The last I knew on my way out the door, they said, well, just make sure that you keep us updated on whatever your current address is so we can forward you information over the years ahead. I'm like, you know, I've got bigger things to worry about in my life now other than making sure you have my current address. I should be made whole on this deal right here and right now.
But they may not allow for that, and it may have been written in the original plan, even without the trouble that 2008 created, that, you know, because of the illiquidity of it and because of the liquidity constraints, where's the money going to come from to buy you out, that they can only buy you out at certain times. And it may have been set up that way from day one. And so just check and see what's going on. And at that point, it does behoove you to give them your current address so that when you do get old enough, whenever the dates are or whatever, when anything that happens, you understand when you can get the heck out of Dodge on this, right?
Yeah, and the bigger concern is that the owners of the company that I worked for about a dozen years are in their 90s. So there's concern that I may not reach my retirement age before they reach their age to pass on.
But they are the former owners of the company. They don't own it anymore. Everybody else does.
Well, I see what you're saying. That's correct. They sold most of the assets of that company to a bigger corporation at the end of 2015. How much of whatever the old company that I worked for still remains from a legal standpoint is hard to say. I mean, the entity is still there.
Yeah, but the money should have gone to the shareholders. So if that company ceased to exist and they bought it out for cash and they retired your shares, there should be cash in the plan that can then be rolled. You need somebody to be able to read this.
Okay.
And find out what is happening with the shares of the company that you are an owner in. Did they do a stock swap when they took over the assets?
Oh, yeah.
Did they give you cash when they took over the assets? What happened upon that change of ownership?
The sale, yeah.
Because in many cases, a change of ownership like this, where it merges in with another plan, creates capital, creates liquidity, which then can be rolled.
Well, good. And let me just give you one final note as to why the middle class is getting clobbered. The new company that bought out the old company, they do not have an ESOP plan for the new employees. And not only that, they just sent us a note via email that said they are not giving a matching contribution for last year's 401k contributions at this new company either. And I said, oh, boy, isn't it just wonderful, saving for retirement.
Isn't that nice?
This new company, when they took over the assets, there had to be something. Did they take over and did they swap out shares? Because is this a publicly traded, the new one?
No, the new company is not publicly traded either.
Okay. Yeah, this has got a lot of fine print in it. And you really need somebody who can read fine print.
Okay, time to go get an attorney and get a magnifying glass. Thank you, fellas, for your help.
Good luck.
Thank you, Ed, for the call. That's a tough situation.
I'd read it over on my own just to begin with. And then as my eyes got glossier and glossier, take a break and try to. But then at some point, you're going to have somebody that actually knows how to read legalese.
Well, what happened was, of course, they had a matching contribution. They got rid of that.
Yeah, but that's not 401k. Uncommon.
No, but then they replaced it with this employee stock ownership plan, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, there carries some risk to it. Is that right?
Well, you are an owner of a company, typically, a company that's not publicly traded, that is difficult to understand what the valuations are. But more important here is another company bought out all the assets. What did they buy them out with? Just an IOU? Did they buy them out with a payment plan? Did they buy them out with cash? Because in a lot of them, if it turns into cash, that should be able to be, for former
spread
employees,
out.
Should be able to be rolled over and then reinvested somewhere. Did they buy them out with a stock swap? So now the original owners of Ed and his fellow employees are now owners to some degree in this new company. How does that work? When can he get to those shares or what? How does he get his value out of this plan is what he's looking for.
Exactly.
And that's all in the daggum fine print.
So that money that it has to be somewhere, right? Is there a chance that it could be just gone?
Well, it can't be just gone because the company bought out. They were bought out.
Yeah, so
some
of these owners should have, they've got some stake in the company.
All the owners have a stake in the company.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't just say, okay, we've got 1 million shares outstanding, and John and I are the former president and CEO of the company.
And we're going to keep the whole thing.
We're going to sell out, and they're all the same shares. We don't have different classes. And we're going to sell out the company, and you and I are going to keep all the money. It doesn't work that way.
No, it can't work that way. So Ed's got something coming to him. We just don't know.
He probably is an owner in the new company. And with the merger, there's probably a restriction on the new company. And whether it's 65 or not, I don't know.
Okay. Well, as long as Ed's not missing all the money that he put into that.
He didn't put any money in the ESOP.
Well, the company did.
Yes.
The company put it in, yeah. All right, 877 Planner. Well, he did sort of by not taking the employee.
No, he didn't have a choice. The company was, the ESOP is 100% company funded.
Johnny Dean, Professor Plum. Bucket strategy investing, you know, if you're in dire straits with your money. All right, I'm kidding.
Didn't go there.
I can't believe I did.
Oh.
I hate when people do that. All right, anyway. Well, you can't work the word Knopfler in very well. So you gotta, anyway. If you need help with your money, and I know a lot of people do. Now, I know we're like a month or so away from the first workshop of the spring series, the 2016 Lucia Capital Group Retirement Income Strategies Workshop. But hey, mark it down, and if you can't sign up now, just give yourself a note to do so. You can, though, sign up. The first one is going to be in Las Vegas, Saturday morning, February 20th. Anywhere in Nevada, you join us. Join Professor Plum, Terry Keyes, and the local advisors there in Las Vegas. Learn all about retirement income strategies and get your money questions answered. So Las Vegas is Saturday, February 20th. Saturday, February 27th, the next weekend, obviously, is going to be in Seattle. And then Phoenix AZ happens on Saturday, March 12th. So the next three, Las Vegas, Seattle, and Phoenix. Over the coming weeks, we will remind you more. And there's going to be more right after that, too, as we continue on through March and parts of April. So check WealthEd.com. You sign up there, WealthEd.com. Sign up. It's free, of course, and you get your money questions answered. Meet the Brain Trust. I mean, gee whiz, this is such a one-sided deal. You get all the good, right? Once again, WealthEd.com. Our phone lines are open, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R, 877-752-6637. Emails at WealthEd.com. Sam in San Jose, California. Let's see if I can get all the information here. Love your show. Thanks for answering many of my previous questions. Sam had a couple of questions before. I have a property in another country, which currently I use as a second home. I do not take any property tax or interest deduction to avoid any complications on my tax returns for foreign property. Both are pretty small. Is there any tax requirement to report a second home in a foreign country on an American tax return? Now, that's the first question, I guess.
Well, the only thing you would report are deductions, and I don't think that the IRS is going to scream if you don't take deductions that you would otherwise be entitled to. They'd scream if you don't show the income, but you don't have income from a second home. So I don't see where you're at any fault, not taking your deductions.
I also have rental property, says Sam, in America, which I report on a K-1. If I convert my foreign property to a rental, do I report the income or loss on K-1 as foreign income on my tax return? Boy.
Well, if you have a K-1, that means that you own the current property in the U.S. inside of an S corporation, or you own it with other partners other than your spouse. That's the only reason you would have a K-1. So whether or not you're going to have the same ownership issues, whether it's going to be part of a corporation or be part of a partnership, dictates whether you'll use a K-1 tax form or whether you use just a regular Schedule E, as in elephant. If you are the only owner, or you and your spouse are the only owner of the property, you don't report it on K-1, you report it on Schedule E. And that's where you put in, all the rents I received, and then all my legitimate, deductible expenses, and then depreciation to come up with a net number, either positive or negative, on the bottom side, and then determine whether or not I can use that as a loss, or I have to show it as profit. So whether you use a K-1 or a Schedule E depends on ownership. Who owns it?
Yeah, now he's got other questions about the depreciation schedule for foreign rental property.
That is one difference between a U.S. property. If it's a rental residence, you know, in the U.S., we can depreciate them over 27 and a half years.
Yeah.
If it's an international property, it's got to be depreciated over 40 years. So it's a slower depreciation, a little bit less of a write-off for in the early years, obviously.
Okay, I hope that answers your question. Sam, I know you had a few others, but Professor Plum, I would imagine, probably answers them or will answer them or did answer them.
Did.
off the air, you got caught up. I know you were a little behind there last week.
Still haven't done that one big one yet.
Oh, the long one. That's right. We read some of that on the air,
right.
I believe, or at least we got.
And I think I'm just going to have to call the individual because there's too many things going on to answer, and I'm just not that good of a typist.
Okay. Well, then if you email us, the best thing to do is keep it, give us as much detail as you can, but keep it as short as you can. That's your challenge.
Oh, yeah. There's
right?
a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. That's it. Yeah. It's like the essays, you know, as a kid. You fit all the information in, but you've only got 500 words to do it in, whatever it happens to be. All right. Now, we have another question, too. This was off the air. It might have been last week, I guess. And there was another email, which we may get to later on, talking about this. But when you do a conversion to when you convert, say, a traditional IRA, a portion of the whole thing into a Roth IRA, and you have a required minimum distribution, you got to be careful doing this.
Well, you can't convert the required minimum distribution.
Right. So
because remember, a Roth IRA is still an IRA. So going from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, you still have IRA money. It just changed the character of the taxation going forward. But it's still an IRA. A required minimum distribution says you have to take money out of and keep it out of the IRA world. IRA world completely. No IRA in the name. Get it out
exactly.
of the IRA.
So if you had, let's say, a $100,000 IRA and you had a $4,000, call it, required minimum distribution, and you decided, well, I'm going to convert $5,000 of this, and that way I'm taking five more than the required minimum distribution out of the Roth, out of the IRA, and I'm doing it and I'm paying taxes on it.
But if all $5,000 ends up in a Roth IRA,
yes,
you have not made a required minimum distribution, and you will be subject to the penalty. And not only the penalty of not getting a required minimum distribution, which is the bigger of the penalties we're going to talk about right now, which is 50% of what the required minimum distribution should have been, so a $2,000 penalty. But there's now $4,000 that you put into your IRA, your Roth IRA, that was an illegal, unacceptable contribution. So now you have an excess contribution to your Roth IRA that's money that shouldn't be there. And you have a 6% penalty for every year you leave it in the Roth IRA. So you got two things going against you here.
So now what makes it an excessive contribution? All I did was take $5,000 out of my $100,000. I converted it to a Roth. I paid taxes on it. What makes that an excessive contribution? Yes.
Because you weren't allowed to contribute. And you didn't have, you know, they're going to look at it in two different sections. Did you make your RMD? No, that's one side of it. Done.
Okay.
Now, where'd the money come from that you put into it? The $4,000 was an RMD, which should not have gone in there, so that's an excess contribution.
Well, even if you were working and you had...
if you have the ability to contribute, that's a different game.
Okay, all right. So that may or may not happen.
Right, so what you could do in that respect is show that the $4,000 came out. You got two different things going on. I did take my required minimum distribution, and I was able to make a contribution. Mm-hmm. Two separate things, even though you kind of handled it in one shot.
Yes. Yeah,
two separate issues, because you can contribute to a Roth IRA even after 70 and a half, as long as you are working. And you can contribute up to whatever you earn, capped off at 6,500 if you're 70 years of age or older. So you could make a contribution. So that is no longer... You
but
did make your required minimum distribution, and you did make a contribution.
Okay, so now, is both the RMD satisfied in this particular situation?
You can, well, yeah, you would show it as a taxable event that I took, it's much cleaner, but the IRS can't see it. I took $4,000 out.
Yes.
And I put $4,000 in. It just happened on one, it's the same money. Money is fungible, and so that's not an issue.
Okay, all right. I just wanted to clear this up, because I had
but
this
question.
But
that's weird.
Well, I had this question. When somebody says, well, I'm still working, I'd be able to make a $4,000 Roth contribution
right.
at age 70 and a half.
So in essence, you took $4,000 out of your Roth IRA.
Out of your IRA.
A traditional IRA.
Yes.
And then out of the checking account, you put $4,000 into. where the money came from, it's the
same thing.
They don't
care. It doesn't matter. You made $4,000. So the contribution would work in this case, but the required minimum distribution is also satisfied.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a situation where it could work.
You didn't tell me it was working.
Well, you have to ask.
At Lucia Capital Group, we believe there are three critical...
Bucket Strategy Investing. You got a knack for answering. No, I said I wasn't going to do that. I'm not doing that. All right.
I'm just impressed you actually knew who Dire Straits was and the
knack. Of course.
Because you stopped listening to music about 81, 82.
No. Dire Straits. Love those guys.
Okay.
Great musicians. Now, this was about 1979,
yeah,
80.
I guess so.
I was still in the fold. Anyway. We are answering your money questions at 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. I want to remind you, too, that if you like this show, you will love the Social Security Show. You get it every Tuesday. Every Tuesday on this program. We try to remind you throughout the week. But on Tuesdays, you want to watch. Go to wealthed.com. That's our website, Wealth, W-E-A-L-T-H, wealthed.com. It's the Social Security Show with me, Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, and all the information that you could possibly use. It's at 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern time. It's only a half hour, so we're in and we're out. But we answer all of your, as many as we can, I shouldn't say all, as many of your Social Security questions as we can on that program. We also talk about laws for Social Security, strategies for Social Security. It's constantly changing, the Social Security system. And, of course, there must be hundreds and hundreds of different scenarios presented by different people. And everyone's situation is different. So you want to watch the Social Security Show. There's a hotline you can call. I'll give it. It is 800-838-0483. That's also available at wealthed.com, by the way. And I should tell you, too, that it's not the Social Security Administration, okay? We get a lot of calls on that hotline asking us questions, but we also get calls from people saying, one I think said that they had needed a replacement Social Security card, and could we send one? Well, you know, we're not the Social Security Administration, we don't do that, but that's where you ask your questions. So again, Social Security Show Tuesdays at wealthed.com. Our phone lines are open, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R, 877-752-6637. Now, I apologize because it's been like a week, maybe more, that I brought this up, and I didn't get to finish it. But last week, I found this in Reuters, and I brought this up with you, Professor Plum, and it was four ways to squeeze inflation risk from your portfolio. We were talking about inflation one day last week. And I found four ways, and these were endorsed, by the way, by some kind of financial advisor type person. Don't know who it was, but that's where they got these ideas from.
But this is for growth or for retirees?
They didn't say.
Because that makes a big difference.
I'm thinking because they put it out for everybody that they said it could be for both, okay? Because anybody could read this. So the first suggestion they had, and by the way, you hated all of these.
So far.
I did three out of the four. I'm going to read the fourth one in a sec. The first one was replace your bonds.
All of them
with Treasury inflation-protected securities.
Nah.
Bad idea. Really bad idea. And we gave you our reasoning. Number one. Number two, they said, try this. Replace your bonds with metals.
Yeah. Okay.
40% of your portfolio in metals?
And having some metals, if you're worried about inflation, I think is a reasonable idea. 40% of your portfolio in metals is a little unreasonable, in my opinion.
Yeah, negatory good buddy on that. So then the third suggestion, which you hated, was reduce your stocks to 50%. They had talked about a 60-40 mix of stocks, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, or whatever else they're suggesting. Reduce stocks to 50%, keep bonds at 30%, and then put 20% in precious metals.
Well, we wouldn't keep bonds. We would reduce stocks by 10% from 60 to 50, reduce bonds from 40 to 30, and use commodities for the remaining 20%.
Yes, yes.
And I think commodities do have a place, just like metals potentially have a place.
Well,
I think commodities have a bigger place, but they're part of the overall growth component, not part of the income component. You're talking about taking the 40% of your portfolio that is driving an income that hopefully is being either a balanced portfolio being reinvested, or that if you're a retiree that you're getting some income from, and turning it into a commodities, which is the most volatile sector of the market. That may help with a little bit of inflation, but most people can't handle the volatility that it creates.
Yeah. Now, you said commodities, which actually was the fourth one.
The
third one was precious metals.
Also adding metals.
This one, instead of having metals, they said half stocks, 30% bonds, 20% commodities. And when we talk commodities, we're talking
Oil.
Oil, yeah. Gas.
And we may have some inflation in oil. Who knows? But we may have such a situation now. Ryan came on last weekend and you know, putting money out, not money, oil out, and we've had such a glut. You know, the experts, what do they know, right? You know, they're saying anything from $10 a barrel to maybe $40, $50 a barrel of oil in the next foreseeable future. They don't see that $100 barrel, which means it probably is right around the corner the way they talk. Are we going to be pushing commodities that high?
Well, isn't it?
And they're talking about inflation. I understand that inflation drives...
Yeah.
All these, but inflation drives stock prices too. The only thing inflation doesn't do well with is bonds. So anything you're reducing bonds by, but this is where we have to differentiate between, are we in the accumulation phase or are we in the growth phase? If this is purely growth money, having commodity exposure, I don't know about 20%, but having commodity exposure does make some sense. Again, within reason. Same thing with precious metals, within reason. But changing the income portion of my portfolio into a more volatile, more risky, less income-driven area of a market, it doesn't make sense to me unless only thing that matters is growth. But if growth is the only thing that matters, why do you have the 40% in bonds to begin with?
You see, and that's why I suspect they were talking about
it's got to be growth.
Everybody.
It's got to be accumulation.
And not a retiree.
That's moronic for a retiree.
Okay, so let's bring this up. You hear this mix. You hear this suggestion all the time. 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Forget the rule of 100 and all that, or whatever that is.
Well, that'd be a 60-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's say that 60% stocks, 40% bonds. What people don't necessarily realize, Professor Plum, is that in that portfolio, the 60% stock is the one you're supposed to leave alone, and the 40% of the bonds, whatever it is supposed to provide the income portion for a retiree.
But that doesn't stay that way. What
No.
happens is, even if they're taking it out of a low volatility area, they rebalance it. And that's what the computers are doing right now. And most advisors want to be as hands-off as possible. They want to set you up and get you started on your distribution, and then they'll rebalance you every 6 months, every 3 months, every year or something, back to the original 60-40 mix in your example there.
Yeah.
So no matter the fact that I'm taking it from the safe side, they rebalance it and it goes back to a 60-40. And the only way to do that is to sell something.
Well, of course, because now you're out of balance. You have a 60%.
And everybody wants to stay in balance, right?
Well, let's say for some wacky reason you took 10% of your bond portfolio to spend it. Now you've got 70% stock, 30% bond.
Well, that would be a 4% distribution.
Okay, well, let's say that you did that. But now they said, well, you're overweighted. You've got 70% stock. So now what do we have to do? We got to reduce our stock. Well, how do you reduce your stock position? You got to sell some of it. And that's, once again, you're selling.
And when the market's going up like it did in 2013-14, it worked great. But then anything works good when the market's doing well. It's times like 15 and maybe 16 so far this year. You know, the first week or two was the worst first week or two ever. And if you needed to take a distribution in the last week or two, you know, first 2 weeks of the year, wasn't a good time to be pulling it out of anything that had any volatility to it. Yes, in the long term, commodities may be able to add some juice to the overall portfolio. Metals, maybe, but that's long term.
Yeah.
That isn't short term.
And this
at all.
And this points out, Professor Plum, the problem.
Oops.
Oh, here's our plums down. Okay.
Oops. That's good.
Plums down on this one. Here's the problem that we see overall with this whole idea of 60% stock, 40% bond, or 70% stock, depending on your age and this kind of thing.
We're trying to make it turnkey.
And you can't.
They're trying to make it so that you can just set it up, and I, as your advisor, can set it up on a computer model and walk away and let the computer do it all for you and not have to worry about it. And, you know, and then I can go play golf, which I am horrible at, and I really do need to go play more because I'll hurt somebody the way I play now.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe automatic is good for my golf game, but it's not necessarily good for you. Sometimes it works really well. Sometimes it doesn't. And when you're in retirement mode, those doesn't times hurt tremendously. That sequence of returns, the loss of principal in the early years where, and then the spending of that principal in the early years when the market's down, if the market's down, really messes up the long-term viability of the portfolio.
No, exactly, which is why we prefer, as we've said, of course, the buckets approach, where you don't have to worry so much. In fact, you really don't have to concern yourself at all what's happening in your bucket three, because you've got plenty of... Well, you do, and perhaps you look at it. It's not a set.
You're looking for opportunity.
Kind of exactly. You're not looking at it to say, gee whiz, I got to take less money this month because I got to sell stocks and the stocks are down.
I was talking with somebody this morning about that, and it was like, well, the person can just take less money out of their portfolio. They stay with their 4% distribution. I start with $1 million, so I take $40,000. It drops by 20%. I've got $800,000, so now I only take, what, $32,000. I don't want the market to tell me what I can and cannot do in my retirement. That is not a good way to – now, if all I do is take 4%, I'll never run out of money because I'm only going to take 4% or whatever the value is. But that means I have a very volatile income stream. And it's not up to me when I do the things in retirement that I may want to do when I want to do them. It's up to whether the market says it's okay. I'm back to asking mommy and daddy whether or not it's okay, except for mommy and daddy don't like me in this case. The market hates me.
Well, can you imagine that? I mean, not finding out until the end of the year that all of a sudden in January you've got to take a, you know, 20% cut in pay and you're retired. 877 Planner. That's no good. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. Emails.
Lucia Capital Group and.
Good strategy investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum here answering your money questions. 877 Planner. We only got a few minutes left in the hour, so if you're inclined to ask a question, you give us a call right now, right quick, as they say, and ask your question. Okay, and you know, use the telephone. Trivia for today before we get to the next email. This from the, oh boy, the Internal Revenue Service.
Uh-oh.
I stand up straight. Sit up straight when we read something from the IRS. They say this, an adjusted gross income, or AGI, of $80,580 was required to rank in the top 1% of U.S. taxpayers in 1980. 80 grand, the top 1%. An AGI of $74,955 was required to rank in the top 25% of U.S. taxpayers in 2013, which is the last data that we had. So if you, in 1980, made a little bit more than $80,000, now I don't know, is this single, married? I have no idea. They didn't say. I'm going to guess it's single. All right? But if you had an $80,000 income in 1980.
That was pretty good.
That was apparently really good. You were in the top 1% of U.S. taxpayers. And now that nearly that 70, if you make just shy of that, 75,000 roughly, you're still in the top 25% of U.S. taxpayers. I would like to know if that's single or married.
That's probably return.
Return? What do you mean?
Whether it's a single return, married filing, joint return.
Well, that's what I mean. So I mean, is that 80,000?
That's probably a married filing, joint return.
Okay, anyway, well, whatever it is.
I don't know, because now, at least as of 2014, it took 380, just over 380, to be in the top 1%.
380,000
a year, just the gross income.
To be in the top 1%.
To be in the top 1%.
Okay, 380,000 as of 2014. Well, okay, all right. Well, I thank you for sending that to me. Don't send me anything else, if you don't mind. Got that in the mail from the IRS. All right, 877 Planner, PLANNER. The emails. Let's get at least one more here before the top of the hour. This is Jesse in Sherwood, Oregon. I currently work for a company based out of California, but I live in Oregon. As a result, I am classified as a California employee, but end up getting taxed twice due to living in Oregon.
And for the average individual, people complain about California, but Oregon's actually a little higher. For the average person.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Now, the high income, California's worse. For the low income and average person, Oregon's got a little bit higher tax bracket.
That's right. So Jesse says that he ends up getting taxed twice due to living in Oregon. Says he's got a California and Oregon income tax. But are you taxed on the same money?
But you do have a credit for the taxes
yes.
paid to to another state.
Yeah,
so he's
really
paying taxes because, let's say he owes $3,000 to California and he owes another $1,000 to Oregon. So
yes.
I'm paying... the combined, I'm paying taxes to California, I'm paying taxes to Oregon. So it looks like I'm paying tax. But if you didn't have the California side of it, if it was purely Oregon income, you'd be paying $4,000 to Oregon.
Exactly. So it can't help. In an effort to, he says, to limit my California tax burden, I initially increased the number of state-level exemptions from my normal one up to three, limiting the California tax that would be removed from my paycheck. I just became eligible, however, for my company 401k plan. I'm wondering what the best ways would be to limit my California tax burden and if contributing to my company's 401k plan would be the best option. Thank you for your help. That's Jesse in Sherwood, Oregon.
Changing exemptions does not change your tax liability in any way, shape, or form. Changing your exemptions changes what we pay on a prospective basis as a down payment towards the ultimate tax liability. So if I, you know, go from maybe with a one exemption, they withhold $300 from my paycheck each time. And so let's say it's a monthly basis, $300, that means I'll pay $3,600 in towards my tax liability for the year. But it didn't change my tax liability. And if I change it to three, they may only take out $200 or $150. So instead of withholding $3,600 for the year, I withhold $1,800 or $2,000 for the year. But it doesn't affect what I actually owe. It just changes what I have to write or get, you know, what I have to write as a check in April when I do my return, or it changes how much I get as a refund.
I think
it doesn't change my tax.
Well, that's why he's saying the amount removed from his paycheck, because he does have to settle up between California and Oregon at the end of the year.
But changing your exemptions, you can change your exemptions and reduce what is being withheld from your paycheck, but it doesn't reduce what you owe. So you either pay it through your payroll, or you pay it in April. Now, if you don't pay enough through your payroll, not only will you make up a check for the difference in April, but you may have a penalty for underwithholding as well. So you don't want to underwithhold. You just want to try to, you know, maybe reduce your refund. If you're getting a refund, sure, from the California side, reduce your withholding. Now, to truly change the tax liability, the amount of money I actually owe California, in your case, would be to change jobs and get an Oregon job, not a California job. If you're going to stay with the same job, the 401k does actually reduce the current income tax liability. So just putting money into the 401k will reduce the money withheld from your check from a tax withholding standpoint and reduce what you actually pay at the end of the year. But obviously you're putting money into a different account, so it'll reduce your overall net check after the fact. I mean, if I put in $1,000 into the 401k, it's going to reduce my check by $1,000. It may reduce what I withhold by $100 by putting that money in. So I'm still out by $900. But it's still the only way to reduce, with the options you've given us, the only way to reduce the actual California tax liability at the end of the year is to change your California taxable income. Change your taxable income across the board. And so that's the 401k will do that. Changing your exemptions is just a prepayment. It just changes how much you're withholding.
Right. Now, he's not, as you said earlier, he's not really being taxed twice on the same money.
No.
I mean, if you made, you know, 50 grand, well, let's see, how would this work, though? You made 50 grand, you live in Oregon, but your company's in California.
Then you do your work in California.
And you do your work in California.
Cross-border or whatever the case may be.
Right. So the taxes that you pay on that money really would be state taxes for California. Where does Oregon come in?
You're a resident of Oregon.
But you're not being taxed on that 50 grand that you made from Oregon.
Oregon, just like California, if I live in Tahoe on the California side and I work in Nevada on the Nevada side, California wants their pound of salt.
Right. I mean, but you can't pay if you owe the same amount, if you owe taxes to California and Oregon, somebody's going to miss out.
Right, Oregon's taking the cut.
Yeah, okay.
The That's resident what I mean. the job where the state where the job is being done gets first crack at it.
That's what it is. Yeah. It's confusing, but that's how it works. Okay, we're out of time for this hour, but if you need the Brain Trust, you want to talk to any of the Brain Trust advisors across the country at Lucia Capital Group, like Professor Rick Plum, you can call them at 800-644-1150, 800-644-1150. For Professor Rick Plum, I'm Johnny Dean. This is Bucket Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provided provide protection from loss or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities, LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities, LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.